I've seen that so much in my career, that scope of work is an elusive term. You know, mm-hmm. think Into the Spider-Verse meets Troll Hunter, but we have $15 actually.
Yeah.
That's not like a scope of work, right? A scope of work is a list of features we're producing together.
Preach, sister, preach.
This is Virginie Lavallée. Virginie started her career as a producer in games and quickly moved on to do TV and film. When she noticed the productions in our industry had much room for improvement, she co-founded Happy Producers, a place where anyone who is interested can join and find healthy yet effective ways to run a production.
Every morning when I reassign or reevaluate the goals, what's my why? Yeah. Personally, my why is my team's well-being. Mm-hmm. Or saying, well, if it doesn't work, we're just going to push it to tomorrow. Like, I'm allergic to that.
Yeah.
That's not a scheduling strategy. Oh, well, if it's not today, it'll be tomorrow. That's not a strategy. I just want to put it out there. Okay. I don't like that. I believe emergencies are not a thing in our industry. We make everything a fake emergency. Mm-hmm. We use the term 911 and things like drop dead deadline, right. Which like, let's retire all of these terms.
Yeah.
When was the last time your life was at risk? At the animation studio? I'm curious to know.
Well, thank you for joining us today. I'm really excited to have you here, especially because we're gonna get a producer's perspective, which is really, really awesome. I think most of these talks have been centered around artists, so it'll be great to get your perspective on things.
Well, thank you for having me. Honestly, I'm really excited.
So how can you tell me a little bit about your backgrounds before you funded Happy Producers, which we'll talk about in a little bit? What were you doing before all this?
I think like many people in production roles and in the production crew and in management positions, I kind of fell into CG. I didn't necessarily like study to become a 3D producer. Mm-hmm. So I was doing a PhD to become a teacher to teach cinema at a university level. And I helped one of my colleagues produce kind of a documentary that they were doing. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I really enjoyed helping people organize people's creative ideas. Mm-hmm. And that I kind of had a natural talent for it that I didn't know about. So I decided to fund my own company and started doing live action short films. So I got to produce a lot of like really, really cool films. Back then I was writing as well, and went on to do my first feature films. We would travel in festivals around the world, and then the strike happens, which like, sounds familiar, right? Having a deja vu. I think it was 2011, and then there just wasn't a lot of work in live action. Honestly, it was hard, and it's kind of like the universe kept sending me opportunities in the CG world. Mm-hmm. And I tried to say no as much as I could. Like, I didn't think it was for me at all. I wasn't, like, into anime. Like, I'd never played a video game in my life, so I didn't think I was the right casting. And I ended up taking a job for Activision, being an associate producer. Mm-hmm. And there were so many challenges. Right. Like, technical challenges, creative challenges. There were a lot of challenges when it came to women in the industry back then. Mm-hmm. And I think the magnitude of, like, the impact that I could have, or that we could have, the people that cared about well-being, if we decided to take on that battle, if I may say, was really motivating to me. Like, I had never worked with such a huge team of like hundreds of people. Mm-hmm. So I kind of fell in love with the challenges and the hard aspects of this industry rather than like the art and everything. And I thought this is really some place where I can impact, I can help, I can, you know, create the workplace culture that I want. And so that's how I got into the CG world. I worked on my first video game without never having played a video game in my life. And then felt like a fraud a little bit because, like, I went on to work on Assassin's Creed, and you have, like, millions of fans waiting for the game. And it was kind of lost on me.
Yeah.
So I wanted to get back into film and television, which is where my passion lies. And so I went and worked in VFX for a while. I worked on Game of Thrones and a lot of really, really cool shows. And the work conditions in VFX were really hard.
Yeah.
Back then, I think like there's still so many challenges today. And I realized that I preferred working on a film from beginning to end rather than just like the little part of the VFX. So that's how I got into animation, I think, in 2014. And I've been full-time in animation since. It's, I prefer the creative process, honestly.
Yeah.
So yeah, I was living in Quebec City, came back to Montreal, worked on so many TV shows.
When films. when you say the hard aspect of things, I would like to get a little bit more specific because it's such a general term, but I understand what you're saying. So when you first joined the video game side of things and you noted some of the holes that were existing in production, how unhealthy it was, what were some of the main things that you were most obvious to you?
I mean, the thing that first stood out to me were that there are specific challenges in the industry that were frustrating people. So instead of having a strategy that was adapted to these challenges, we were trying to change the nature of the design of the industry. So for example, it's an industry in which we're always iterating because it's a creative process, and that would frustrate people. We're always changing our mind, we're trying new things, and yeah. I was thinking that's not something we're gonna be able to change because that's inherent to the creative process. Mm-hmm. But we can have better processes in the production team to support that. We can have better soft skills so that we promote flexibility and adaptability. So always iterating was one of them. The technical challenge, the pipeline is always changing. There's always a new render. There's always a new cool thing. There's always a new feature. And that seems to be creating a lot of frustration on people too, because you learn one and then already it's obsolete and mm-hmm. you always have to be getting up to date. And I was like, how about we see that as a strength, that we have the opportunity in our industry to always be growing and always be learning. And
so what you would do on your end would be to allot time to allot more time for us to process those things, or what would be your reaction as a producer?
Well, in the production team, for mm-hmm. me, where there's stress, we're usually missing a process.
Right.
So if something stresses you out, then instead of being frustrated and saying we're gonna work overtime or that's how it is, I would say okay, let's revise our process. And I like a 5-step process. it doesn't have to be complicated. We make mm-hmm. things way too complicated. So I would always see stress or frustration as an opportunity to do better. So a lot of it is with the processes, with streamlining the way that we do things in the production team. We forget, or we don't like it because it doesn't sound cool. Mm-hmm. We forget that the production team is a supporting team. We play a supporting role. We're here to support the creative process. We're not just, it's not an ego-driven position. I don't want to be right. I want to make the right decisions for the project. So
that's so important. I want to put that on a t-shirt.
And I think the production crew is seen as such a controlling team.
Yeah.
Because we get to say no, we get to say yes, we get to say you stay over time. And it's super important to know that we are here to make the artist shine. And it was the same thing in live action for me. My role is to make people shine because mm-hmm. I'm not actually animating anything.
Right.
And we all need each other. It's the epitome of team sport, the animators need us, we need the animators, we need our client, we need their broadcaster. We all need each other, but it does become this power struggle.
So let me ask you this. So when you talk about iterations, I know, I'm deeply familiar with the iterations from the art perspective, but would you say that you then approach your, scheduling style very show specific, and it's also iterative, right? Because I feel like a lot of the times, or at least the amount of experience I've had so far, there's kind of one way to approach it from the production side, and it doesn't really change even if, circumstances change, because the circumstances are something in the beginning of a project and then they sort of evolve over time and sometimes change a lot.
Definitely.
And the schedule doesn't always change with it. So it really, how would you handle that? Or are you open to changing that kind of thing as you go?
Definitely, the schedule is alive.
Yeah.
And I think in the production crew, what we need to have before anything else is flexibility. Mm-hmm. And adaptability. So the, scheduling is an art as well. That's something that we forget. We think it's putting an end date in a spreadsheet, and mm-hmm. it's actually a strategy. It's a mindset. Mm-hmm. It's a team culture, the way that we schedule. So it is a journey learning how to schedule. Mm-hmm. And it's very important. At the Happy Producers, we give courses on scheduling for well-being so that you avoid overtime and overages. And because the thing is, if your schedule is not flexible, then any surprise translates into overtime. And then if every surprise is overtime, everybody's gonna hate surprises like very, very fast, right?
Right.
So with the schedule, there are many, many stages in scheduling. There's an original like promise mm-hmm. that you have with your clients, maybe with their broadcaster, maybe with their financiers. So there's definitely like benchmarks, right? And there's a destination we need to reach. But the way that we create a schedule is to keep as much flexibility in there as possible
right.
while establishing benchmarks that we know for sure we're gonna hit.
Right.
So you wanna promise your clients and manage expectations with your clients where you're putting your team in a really comfortable position to make sure we're going to over-deliver. And the thing is, in the schedule, we think that there are only tasks. So you did the animation bid, I take that bid and I put it in the schedule, but if there's 40 hours per artist in my schedule, mm-hmm. that also includes, you know, meetings,
yeah.
technical downtime, because their computer wasn't working,
mm-hmm.
them being sick, somebody in their family being sick and needed support, them just not feeling optimal that day. Then there's everything that could happen. What if the internet is down for, you know, everybody in Montreal
yeah.
one day? There's nothing we can do about that. So you need to plan for the unplannable. You need to mm-hmm. plan for the unexpected. And that's where you want to be data-centric.
Mm-hmm.
And from one production to the other, gather your metrics to know, I always need like a 10% buffer or a 15%
yeah.
buffer, because I don't know what the surprise is going to be, but I know for sure. Like,
yeah.
surprise is like the...
It's gonna be there for sure.
The yeah. little sprinkle on top of the production cake, it's gonna be there. So how do I keep that space? Anything else, I'm setting myself up for failure, and my team as well. I'm being disloyal to my team. So for me, scheduling is not just I put numbers and estimates. It's like, what's my inspiration
yeah.
when I show up scheduling? When every morning when I reassign or reevaluate the goals, what's my why?
Yeah.
Personally, my why is my team's well-being.
Mm-hmm.
Could be different for the people, but my why is, how do I avoid overtime? How do I make sure people's mental health is a priority? How do I make sure that we have the best conditions to do our best work and that we're reaching our goal, but not by me saying that's how it is, I said so, and like mm-hmm. push or saying, well, if it doesn't work, we're just gonna push it to tomorrow. Like, I'm allergic to that.
Yeah,
that's not a scheduling strategy. Oh, well, if it's not today, it'll be tomorrow. That's not a strategy. I just want to put it out there.
Okay.
I don't like that.
And how do you, okay, so if your priority or your why is your team's well-being, how do you handle the situation where the clients are pushing for something that is kind of against what your why is?
So, you know, client relationships are a superpower.
Yeah.
If you're in the production team, it needs to be like one of your priorities that you want to be great at developing client relationships that are based on trust. Managing expectations is something that is totally learnable as well, that you
mm-hmm.
need to possess if you're in the production crew. But then also, like, as much as like well-being and people's happiness is my why, my strategy is also to be extremely like documented and data-centric. So
mm-hmm.
if we have a clear scope of work, like, I've seen that so much in my career, that scope of work is an elusive term. You know,
mm-hmm.
think Into the Spider-Verse meets Troll Hunter, but we have $15 actually.
Yeah.
That's not like a scope of work, right? A scope of work
right.
is a list of features we're producing together. It's a promise we make each other.
Yeah.
It's a common language and an understanding we have. It's like going to the grocery store. It's
right.
a list of things. So the first thing you need in order to be able to not have your clients come in the way of your why is to have a very clear scope of work so
yeah.
that they understand and they're not surprised, so that you understand, so that the team understands. The thing with the production crew is sometimes we keep all the information for us. You want the team to have all that information as well,
okay.
so that they understand what we're doing together. I'm not just saying it's due for Friday because I said so. It's because
yeah.
this is the context, this is the inspiration of why. So to manage client expectations, you need a few things to be documented, like the scope of work. You need to have a production timeline. That's a very, very, very macro schedule, very macro schedule where you have benchmarks that you can look at together so that you can track progress. But then if your client comes and asks things that are outside of the scope of work, then there's a process for that, right?
Right.
So first things, we're going to need to, you know, we don't say yes, but we also don't say no.
Let me confer with my team.
Let me see with my team. Yeah. Yes.
Right.
First of all, it reminds them that there's human people behind what they're asking. Like, these people are going to need to stay overnight or something to do this. So let's evaluate. Is it a 2-hour task?
Yeah.
Is it a 48-hour task? Like, that's not the same discussion.
Yeah.
Is it a low-level risk? Is it a high-risk situation? Like, we've never done it. We don't know it's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Also, like, when a client asks for something, often they're going to bring a solution. Oh, can a team do this? And it's like, what's the problem you're trying to solve?
Right.
Because it's possible that your animation team has a better idea.
Right, right, right.
So what's the problem? I'm here to help you fix a problem. Tell me the problem. Don't give me what you think might be the solution.
Right.
But then if we all decide together that that's the solution, like, let's evaluate it together. And then if it's more than 2 hours, you know, everybody has different parameters. But let's say anything under 2 hours, we'll say yes. But anything else needs to be reevaluated. Then do they want to remove something else?
Right.
Like
make compromises to what they're asking for. Right?
There's so many hours in a day. There's so many, like, dollar signs at the end of our budget, right? So, like, we think that our client sometimes is some kind of, I don't want to say a bully, that's rude, but, you know, the client always wants everything, and the client doesn't care about the people is, like, one of the stereotypes. And we forget that actually it's the client's job to see what they can get away with.
Right.
So if they're not pushing for it, they might not be filling their task description.
Mm-hmm.
But your task description is to gatekeep the scope of work.
Mm-hmm.
So they expect you to say no. Like, it's probably not their first rodeo. They've done shows probably. They expect that you're going to say no to a few things, but they're going to try. Because if you say yes, it doesn't change anything for them.
Mm-hmm.
They're not working overtime. They're, you know, not paying for it. So it's really like a dance of, but also like remembering, your client's a person, and they have their task description. A director that doesn't ask for more is not doing their job. Like, that's as simple as that.
I think more than, I don't want to speak for everybody else, but I think another thing that's kind of big, and I think a pressure that I have felt myself, is wanting to agree with the client, not because I feel like they're going to, you know, look down on me or whatever, but more so because I want to stay competitive compared to other productions. And so I think that's kind of one of the biggest, like, I guess, stressors for you guys as producers and for us as animation supervisors, because we're constantly trying to bid something that is good for our team but also stays competitive so that we can, seem like we are somewhat productive in our workflow. So. How do you stay competitive with still keeping your team's well-being in mind?
I think, like, getting a client to come work with your team rather than going to the other studio, or getting a client to bring their next show in your studio, you know, after we've completed this show, is really more based on the relationship that you're building with them, on the experience that they have. Like, what I want is to make their lives easy so that they say, oh, with Virginie, like, it's simple, it's easy, it's pleasant, it's not stressful. I want to produce everything with her team, you know? So the artistic aspect of it is paramount. But, like, the people in our industry are so, so talented and so innovative. And, like, can you believe it? Like, how great the people are, like, that we work with. It's unbelievable. So I think, like, most teams do amazing work creatively.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's a given, that in Montreal, for example, like, you get great work pretty much everywhere you go, then what sets you apart, like, above that? And it's not going to be that it costs, like, $5 less for me to do this shot than it would at the other studio. It's going to be, what's the conditions in which we're creating together?
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be more, is the animation director full of solutions? Or are they always just saying, like, no, or we can't do that, or, you know, I don't want to talk to the director? Or are they like, yes, let's brainstorm, let's figure it out, let's, you know, we tend to forget that. Or I don't know, I think we do tend to forget that, but it's the narrative that's the most important thing at the end of the day. It's how are we telling the story?
Right.
So what clients want And I think for a while there was a season where it was like the cheapest work for the highest quality.
Yeah.
Now what they want is somebody that's going to bring solutions,
right,
and somebody that's going to involve them in the creative process. That's not going to just bring all the solutions, but are going to be like, let's talk about it together.
Mm-hmm.
What's the intention and how are we getting there? So yeah, it's important to bid like correctly, but we have a course about bidding too that is ongoing now. The whole first part is about building trust.
Mm-hmm.
If you have trust, then, you know, let's talk about how much your ID costs. And maybe it's less expensive to do it in another country. Maybe, you know, across the street, yeah, it's $10 less, but do I trust that when it's hard, we're gonna go do this together? That when I'm unhappy, we're gonna find solutions?
Mm-hmm.
That when it doesn't look the way that we expected, that we're gonna get there?
Mm-hmm.
That's like even more important, I would say, and it's kind of like an invisible factor.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we don't see that. We don't have a pie chart of how is the trust with the client,
yeah,
this week, you know? But that's probably the
mm-hmm.
most important metric. So
mm-hmm.
having an animation director that can speak with a client,
yeah,
that is confident, you know, putting forward ideas, that's flexible, that manages expectations, that's really the key to preserving the well-being of the team.
Yeah. I'm really impressed with how, like, your initiative to open up happy producers and really basically spread the knowledge and really try to make a difference in production. Because I do agree with you that it's not necessarily, I mean, there are some good productions out there, but I do think that its majority is very, like, stress-inducing situations.
Yeah.
And I think our industry is like highly collaborative. There isn't a way around it that you can't really, unless you know you're building a really small maybe mobile game or something, you could do that maybe. But I would say even there you
mm.
need more than one person. So, I always thought for some reason that there was a big hole between producers and clients in terms of explaining the animation process. So not just managing expectations, but also like explaining what they're gonna see, because the animation process is not gonna look pretty right away.
Yeah.
It takes a while to get there, and it's not always easy to explain to people, like, you know, when you see this, you shouldn't comment on the color, you should comment on,
yes,
you know, the acting, or you shouldn't comment on, you know, or you know, you also want to get their first impression, so it's okay for them to comment on the color, but quite often we'll show an animation version to the client, and then they will get back to us with notes about lighting or
yes.
something, where the shot is not even lit yet, you know? So, and I feel sometimes a bit frustrated. I don't know where to point the finger, and I don't want to point fingers at just the producers, because I'm sure there's more to it than that, but I do feel like there's a big hole there about how to explain that. Do you think it's important for the producers themselves to, like, know the animation process and be able to communicate it?
I think, like, the more you know about all the fabrication steps,
mm-hmm.
the better equipped you are definitely to make the right decisions for the project, the show, the film, the cinematic.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. Without, like, having to know how to do it yourself, like, I could not animate anything outside of, like, Canva, probably.
Yeah.
Not, I can't animate a slide. But just understanding mostly, like, the workflow steps. Like,
mm-hmm.
that's where in the production team we really need to be knowledgeable, because with the client, like, that is such a good point that you bring forward, and I feel like I was listening to myself talk when you were saying this, because that is so true, the lighting notes at the blocking stage, right?
Yeah.
Or in the layout, you know?
Yeah.
And you're like, no. And I think, like, many things. So let's start with the client. Like, we should never, like, just assume how much the client knows about CG animation.
Right.
And you're definitely gonna need to hold their hand without telling them you're holding their hand. Like, it's not a gracious way of saying it, but you need to accompany them in knowing, like, what we're doing. And I think, like, the review process is so important. So we talked about the scope of work. So for me, like, there are really, like, three things that need to be, like, extremely clear to the clients. You have the scope of work, you have the production timeline, which is, like, a very macro schedule of the fabrication steps, And then you have the review process. And it's important internally as well that you have extra clarity about this, because there are so very few projects that you get to have the free buffet, you know, the endless iterations, because that's attached to, the amount of iterations is attached to a price. When we bid it, when we bid this film, there's a number of retakes that's included. So let's say that's two passes of retakes at every fabrication step, for example. The client needs to know that as well, first of all, so that they know that it's serious. You're gonna see layout twice. So don't think, oh, you know, I was doing something else and giving the review notes at the same time, and then we'll see later. We will not see later. We will be in animation later. And we will have locked a few things that we will not roll back on. So it's important to let them know how many retakes they get, but then also what are we locking at each stage? And now the artist listening to this might not love like the term locking because adaptability and flexibility and fluidity, of course. But there are things that we want to have the client commit on, you know? So at layout, it's gonna be a lot of camera work that we're gonna want to have a really good idea of narratively. Do we have the right like cameras? Are we using the right sets? Which characters are on set? And then at blocking, you know, we will try to lock the cameras. And then at spline, we will do more body animation. And then at the polish, we'll be looking at the facial animation and the secondary animation. If your client doesn't know that, they're, you know, it's not their fault. And sometimes they've done many shows, so you're like, they should know this. Like, oh my God, this client, ugh, you know? But every show's different, every production team's different. Maybe nobody ever, like,
explained it.
Took their courage to say, like, we're going to be in this together, but this is what we're looking at. I worked with a huge Hollywood director, that would talk about nothing but lighting at the layout phase. And then I, you know, was more like, I was more careful because it was such a huge name and you get intimidated a little bit. But then they told me, like, I need you to tell me exactly at this stage, what do you want notes on? And then at the other stage, because he wanted to provide what we needed. We always assume that the client doesn't care, but no, they want to give us what we need. They want to reach the goal. And sometimes it's like, what's the easiest way of reaching the goal? So more so than like, how do we do things in an animation scene? It's really like, what's the workflow that we're working with? What's expensive to like be finicky about at the lighting stage? What do I want to lock earlier because it's going to save us time and money and therefore be conducive to my team's well-being? And then be game to like tell the client like, well, for this production, here is what we're suggesting, right? That this is what we should lock. We should lock 70% of the cameras at blocking and this and that. And then that also helps us discover what are their must-haves. If they're like, no, we want to touch cameras all the way till the end. Okay, well, are we really willing to make a concession on something else? Lock something else more easily, have less retakes at texture, I don't know. Or are we willing to have a bigger budget where, all right, well, for an extra million, you can touch the cameras all the way till the end if you want. That's important to know. Sometimes, like, they don't know the impacts as well, the clients. And it helps them to know, well, if we touch cameras at the lighting stage, then we have to go, we have to roll back on all these decisions. Or if at the lighting stage, you give me modeling notes on the main character.
It's also, like, really huge on morale for the team, too. Because from our perspective, we also want to make the client happy. So it's not like we don't care. Like if we hear a note, you know, on a polished stage that they don't like the action that the character's doing, you know, obviously we know our producer might push back on that, but we're also like, you know, kind of, you know, shit, I really was hoping that you would be happy with the work that I'm doing. So it's kind of a big deal, not just for monetary reasons, but also for, you know, mojo, morale, you know? Like, we want to make the client happy. So, yeah, definitely taking a little bit more time to explain those things and communicate with the client about them is important.
And have them documented. Like, for me, they're in the contract. Like, these things are an annex to the contract. So we're not discovering this as we go. And then, oh, like, the client thought something else, and now they're disappointed, and we're breaking the trust because we were lacking clarity. No, we had clarity like in advance, and then if we get to polish animation and they realize they want extra time or I don't know what, then we can renegotiate. But based upon an agreement that we had, based upon like hard information and not opinions and perceptions that we said out loud, but that we don't have a document, that there's no like paper trail of, like that's very important for the production crew. Things need to be documented. And not so that it can be like, I told you so, well, as per this document, but more to be like, okay, this is the common language we speak together. If we start spelling a word differently, what are the impacts? Are you going to pay for these impacts, you know, negotiate for these impacts, yes or no? Yes, okay, no. Sometimes they'll realize like, oh, I didn't know this is gonna take 8 weeks to address this retake,
which
right?
is so fair, because they're not aware of the technology.
Or again, it's their job to ask, and then it's our job to like provide the clarity. I think also like having a good process around receiving client notes, like that's one of the spaces in my production where I could see there was a lot of frustration. Every time we would get client feedback, somebody would get mad, right? So either there are too many notes, they say the contrary that they said the last time, it doesn't follow the brief, we don't like their idea, the comments are rude. Like I've had like to work with horrible feedback that you had to like hide the feedback from the artist because it was inappropriate to talk that way to anybody, let alone like the artist producing this contents with you. So I think it's important to have a process where, for me, the production crew gets the notes. We get the notes and then we analyze them. Which one is an easy yes, we're addressing that, it's not long and it makes sense. Which one is contrary to what they said in the past, so that we can just revalidate with them. Is that what you meant? Because last time you said blue and now you're saying red, and we're just, we just want to validate, no opinion, just validating. Anything that's like a technical issue that we have on our side that we keep reproducing every time we send a delivery, the client's like, well, yeah, well, you know, you have a continuity issue. Well, we're going to want to fix that internally, because then it's like too many notes from the client. Well, these ones are like, these ones were on us, actually. Let's use that to like have a better process. And then which ones are just rude, way too much. We don't want to address them. I don't even need the team to see them. You know, so having a little gatekeeping of the feedback, and that's not necessarily possible in every single team at every single time, but having a process around notes. So that, first of all, feedback is not personal. It's not about us. It's about the shot. Like that's a way.
Yeah, that's super important.
That's actually a way different thing, right?
Yeah, I spend years like perfecting this mentality because it does feel a bit personal in the beginning of your career, I think. But it's really important for us to realize that, like, no, we're creating something together, and the feedback is for what we're creating, and you're under a certain set of circumstances when you're creating it. But yeah, that's always hard for the team. So I do also do that. I do filter also notes, and I make sure I keep out the stuff that I think is irrelevant or whatever. But I think that's super important. Yeah.
And also, like, shots are gonna get cut. You know, some assets are not going to make it. Some of my ideas as a producer are like not creative ideas, but some of my processes are not going to make it. You know, that's one of the challenges I was mentioning at the beginning. That's one of the challenges in the industry. It's never happened to me. Like, I'm very blessed, but the co-founder of The Happy Producer, he worked on the whole film. The film was complete and it never came out. And it came out last year, I think, but that was 10 years later.
Oh my gosh.
So we can't like put our motivation in the end result, right? Yeah. And we tend to do that because I want to win an Emmy, I want to go to the Oscars, I want my grandma to know what I'm working on. I, you know, that's the grandma factor of my content. I want people to be proud. I want my name in that end credits, and like that's fine. But like the motivation is in the everyday journey we're taking together to get there. Like that's where the motivation is, because it's out of our control. What's end up on screen, if it doesn't even end up on screen, this interview is gonna last throughout the ages. So it might not always be relevant, but right now with everything that happened with the strikes and everything, I don't want to throw numbers out there, but more than a third of like the shows that were ongoing got canceled just in the last quarter of the year. That doesn't mean the people working on it weren't absolutely great or deserving or worthy or, you know. So sometimes it's just like totally outside of our control, and maybe that shot would have looked great on our demo, but like it's about like what's the best decision for the film, and some things are not going to make it in there, unfortunately.
Yeah. Do you have any like clients that you wouldn't work with again or stuff like that?
My worst client I've ever had were best friends now, you know? They don't live here in Canada. We see each other at international events and we're so excited to see each other. But they were my hardest, like by far inappropriate, you know, like bullying clients. But it's such a privilege in the production team to be able to influence your internal team, first of all, but also the people that you're working with on the other side. And again, like, you can't take it personal. So for me, like, this really hard client, they would always scream. They would always scream. And, like, I don't scream personally. Even at the children. Like, that's just not one of my ways of negotiating things. Like, I can get frustrated and things, but that's not how I'm going to express it. Everything was screaming. They would say, lock the door and have everybody stay overnight. Like, we don't care.
Oh, my gosh.
It was in a period of the industry where I was here in the Myland, and I was like, if I do that, tomorrow they're working at the studio across the street where they're going to offer them, like, bigger salaries. It's a very competitive market here. Like, I can't just treat my – I wouldn't want to, but also. So I think when you have a hard client, you have to remember yourself to, like, be true to your own values. So I remember – these clients, if I can, like, say a little episodic experience I have with them, they were very upset about the progress on props. We were doing a 78 episodes together, so it's a lot, like, it's a lot of volume. And it was a really cool show. It was already sold in, like, you know, 60 countries back then, and now it's across the world. And we were all very excited about it, but, like, props progress. It was in props, we're not progressing fast enough or something. Like, I don't really, you don't remember really the details years later. And they said, let's talk tomorrow. We're not in the same country, so let's Zoom tomorrow. So you're like, yeah, sure, fine. And you, I think it's me and the other producer Zooming, and I show up, and there were 15 of them.
Oh, my gosh.
And, like, 12 of them I had never met. So you had, like, the director of finances and then the director of the studio and, like, the HR director.
Applying pressure.
Like, a lot of people I had never met. None of them introduced themselves. And they all started screaming simultaneously. And so I texted my head of production.
Like, you should be here right now.
Bring me a glass of water.
SOS or wine.
No, but I was like, if ever this becomes, like, because there were so many other people, I was like, if ever this becomes, like, a legal issue, or, like, I don't know, if it's above my head, like, let's just have support. And the head of production came in, but didn't come on screen. They sat, like, in the corner of the room. And I just told them, like, the I can feel you're stressed. So if you're screaming, what is it telling me? You're probably stressed. I can feel this seems to be stress-inducive for you. Is that so? And they were like, yeah, like, obviously, we're here bullying you on Zoom. Like, read between the lines, Virginie. And I was like, okay, so what is stressing you? Progress on the props? Okay, so let's open Chagrin. Let's look at the progress report. You know, you're scared that we have too much work left. Well, let's look at the metrics. Like, my answer is always in the metrics. Well, we've actually completed 83% of the props, which is exactly the benchmark that we wanted to reach by this stage. And then we have, like, 48 man days left or labor days left of props, which means that in, like, 4 weeks, all the props are approved by the broadcasters. We had a lot of broadcasters approval on this one. So my metrics are telling me that we're, this is a fine situation. And, oh, okay, because you got an email where you didn't understand properly and then it stressed you out and then you guys, like, created this whole story on your side of the world about the problem that isn't a problem, because not my opinion is telling me it's not a problem, my metrics are telling me it's not a problem. So, you know, we looked at the numbers, we made a process, you're stressed, let's put a process in place, you know? For the next 4 weeks, here is how we're going to track progress so that you feel comfortable. I want you to feel comfortable as well. But so that the team doesn't work overtime neither. Okay, deal. Shake on it. I'll send you an email so that we have a paper trail that we just agreed on this. And then, like, we ended up the call. And my head of production told me, we were at the beginning of the 3-year production, you know, and my head of production told me after this call, you have my full permission to start screaming back at them. And, like, I appreciated the support, but I was like, that is not the producer I want to be. If this is my dream job, if we've been bidding on this show for 4 years, like, it takes a long time to get a show to come in. It was a co-production, so we went and got financing. we, you know, casted the actors with them. We were really involved. I want this to be my dream job. Mm-hmm. I don't want this to be
a screaming match.
I come in the morning and like, that's not fun for me. Mm-hmm. And am I being selfish? Maybe. I want this to be my dream job. Yeah. Like, that's always kind of like my MO. This is a cool field that we work in. I don't want it to be like a horrible experience at work. So I told them, like, my head of production, I said, I appreciate like the support. And I don't think many head of productions would have said that. So like, I see them in my head and I'm like, yes. But I told them, like, is it okay if I just stay true to my own values and I do it my way? Mm-hmm. And they said, okay. They said, like, as long as you don't, you know, feel burned out from all the stress they're putting on you, or that it doesn't, you don't take it personal that they're screaming. So I never screamed, and we would have calls very calm. Like, stress is contagious.
Yes.
Being calm is extra contagious. So I would be calm. Anytime there would be stress, we would look at numbers. Anytime there would be an issue, we would bring solutions. And probably within like 3 months, there was no screaming anymore. Like, no screaming. They would smile. We would laugh. So we had like a pleasant 3 years after that, where it could have been 3 years from hell.
Yeah.
And I decided I was going to influence. I was going to lead by example. And they were more senior than me. Like, they had more experience than me and everything, right? Mm-hmm. But sometimes your client's bad attitude doesn't belong to you. It could be another experience they had on another show that was horrible. It could be another producer they worked with that bullied them, so now they're on the defensive. Like, usually somebody's bad attitude, even in the theme, like, if your supervisor's always grumpy, most likely doesn't belong to you. Mm-hmm. It's probably like a defense mechanism from something else. So let's just disarm that.
It's also very also a very important point to keep in mind when supervising an animation from the artist side. You're also constantly, I do feel like sometimes there's some stress coming in from production, and so we have to be, like, it's okay to vent, but not necessarily with the team itself, because you don't want to, like you said, being calm is contagious, and
yeah. There can be a space for venting.
Yeah.
If it's needed. Personally, because I'm in the production crew and I like my metrics, I'm like, if we're going to vent, I'm going to make it efficient. So we're going to have a venting session where the production crew is going to take notes. That's frustrating everybody. Okay. Yeah. We're going to need a process around that. The client keeps doing that over and over. Okay. Mm-hmm. We're going to need a process around that. Let's make it efficient. But it's okay to blow off some steam. It's a high-pressure job.
Yeah.
Which, like, it's hard to believe sometimes, because we're creating content that brings happiness to the world, you know, but to the people watching it. So sometimes, like, why is it so high pressure, and who decided?
Yeah.
Like, who decided that the client got to bully us? And I think it's important to remember, if your production team with a supervisor, even a supervisor with an artist, or a production team with a client, or a supervisor with a client, like, I believe, like, in circular relationships, because teamwork, like, we need each other. Mm-hmm. So we all have equal power, like, equal power, different responsibilities, equal power, different task descriptions, but we all have equal power. There isn't a top dog and a bottom dog, you know? I don't know if that's appropriate to say, but there isn't, like, what? There isn't like somebody that's more important that they're on top. And sometimes we'll see the client that way because they bring in the money, but like, they need us. They have the money. We have the talent, right? Mm-hmm. And other clients have money as well. Like, the world is made of nothing but money. So, so sometimes they're like, oh, we need to, but like, I cannot like stress that enough, like, equal power, different responsibilities. So for me in the production team, I'm not the boss of the animation supervisor. Mm-hmm. I have a really different task description than the animation supervisor, but like, we are equal in our relationships.
That's actually a good segue. I wanted to ask you also about boundaries with, like,
yes, I love you.
With like, as a producer, I have felt sometimes, I think Evan can agree, there's some situations where the producers are giving animation notes, or you know, kind of involved in the creative, you know, process of things, yes. Which is okay. I think everybody can say their opinions about things. It's just sometimes gets muddy, or things get pushed back because of that situation,
yes.
Or you're in a client meeting and the producer starts commenting on different, you know, creative ideas. Where it's fine. It's just it's a situation. Most of the time, there's so many people that already have a say in the creative aspect of things, and having an extra person can get a little bit muddy. So what would you say to that from production side?
I think boundaries are extremely important, as you yeah. were mentioning. Also, like, I keep mentioning task descriptions is because we don't pay enough attention to our task description. Mm-hmm. And it's a job where it's easy to start playing in everybody's playground.
Yeah.
But, like, we have our own playground, and our responsibility and our accountability is attached to our task description. Mm-hmm. As a producer, it's not my job to give creative notes,
right?
My coordinator cannot give bigger lips, you know, like that's really not our position. So if your producer starts doing that and it's not like conducive to reaching the goal together, mm-hmm. then sometimes it's just important to... So the thing with task descriptions and boundaries is that we cannot tell other people what their boundaries are, but we can be very, very clear about what our boundaries are. Mm-hmm. So you can sit with your producer and say, like, it's my understanding, and I could be wrong, that any, like, creative feedback about animation is really, like, my responsibility, and that I'm accountable for it, and that at the end of the day, like, I'm the one that's gonna have to put that in motion. Would you agree? Yes, you agree. Okay. So, because I think you have great ideas, I don't know if that's the case, but sometimes in a meeting, if I'm giving an idea and you're giving a different idea, it's not conducive to us meeting the goal with the client. And always giving the context of why it's the best thing for the show, not, well, my ego gets hurt and yeah. I think your ideas suck. Like, mind your own business, but be more like, okay, how do we best reach the goal together? Mm-hmm. And is that helping us? Because I notice sometimes it adds work that we could have avoided. I notice sometimes it creates doubt in the client's mind, where before the client seemed to be certain about something. Mm-hmm. And I just want to be transparent that this adds labor days, that this adds time to the calendar, that we're not mm-hmm. working overtime to address, like, mm-hmm. additional internal notes. So how do you foresee, like, what is the solution that you would propose about that? Because the thing is, because there's so much feedback in what we do, and that's not something you have in all the industries. Like, if you work at the bank, you're not getting that much feedback. Like, yeah. us every day, we're in reviews, we're in dailies, yeah. we're, like, every day we're facing criticism and mm-hmm. everything. And it makes us feel like everybody's opinion is important. But it's not opinion when the person that's accountable for giving the feedback is giving the feedback. It's doing their task description. Mm-hmm. It's doing their job. When it's not in your task description and you start giving feedback, then it's your opinion, mm-hmm. right? And it's possible that, like, your opinion is okay and it's valid and we all have opinions. That doesn't mean that it's a metric of, like, a decision factor. That doesn't mean that it's the right place to take a decision. So if the producer is like, well, I talked to the client in person and, you know, privately, and they said they want my feedback, then you could let them know, okay, well, it seems to be adding, like, 10 to 20 mm-hmm. labor days every time we have a client call. So how do you and the production crew would like to suggest that we absorb this in the team without, like, having overtime, or without, like, the artist being at the receiving end of this impact? Mm-hmm. And then it's going to be their responsibility to, if they're like, well, maybe we should do a change order with the client, mm-hmm. fair enough. Oh, yeah, maybe we need to renegotiate with the client that we do less lighting after that, like, and we yeah. add an animator. Fair enough. But it's always, like, metric-oriented. If it adds time, somebody's doing overtime.
Yeah, yeah.
And overtime costs money, not only, like, in my budget, but in the mental health of the people I work with. Yeah. Somebody doing overtime all the time is more at risk of a burnout, is more at risk of quitting to go work somewhere else, is more at risk of not doing their best work because they're tired. That translates into losing money as well, yeah. right? Mm-hmm. So always keep it, like, very metric oriented. It adds work, this amount of work, yeah. or, you know, it slows us down, or, like, what are the impacts, but, like, mm-hmm. specifically, like, hard information. Mm-hmm.
Would you say that you, like, your relationship with the animation directors or the animation team itself is as important as the client relationship?
Yeah, I mean, maybe even more, because, I mean, I don't want to say more because, like, let's all love each other, but you work more closely with your animation director, and there's no competition. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not, I only have enough love for one or the other, right? Or I only have enough time and trust and respect for one or the other, but the producer should always be protecting their team, because you're gonna work with that animation producer like on a for a long time. I work with the same animation director for like 6 years, and I think about them and I'm getting teary, like I love them. You know, so what you're building together is a lot more than this shot or this delivery or, you know, this project even. It's more like, how do we make this your dream job as well? How do we make this like the artist's dream job? Which I don't know that a lot of producers are like necessarily thinking that way, but I'm on a mission to,
to change it. Influence, yes. I love this mission.
To influence people, but all of your supervisors are extremely important, and building trust with everybody. Like, David Horsager is a trust expert. He has a podcast, writes books, and he says that every single problem we have at work, and I think it applies in life too, always stems from a lack of trust, like always. So be intentional about building trust, and there are 8 behaviors that we can use like every day to compound the trust that we build together. Let's be intentional about them.
Yeah.
If you're against your producer, your supervisor, so I worked at a studio, there was more than one physical location on the same street, which, like, am I saying too much? Now are people, like, connecting the dots? It's like, how many studios? There were more than one location on the same street, so we'd had to go from, like, one building to the other. And the production crew, when we would walk in, the supervisors would go running back the back door.
Right.
We'd come in, and we'd see them, like, ooh, and with a little dust. You know? And they would go, oh, no, we don't want to talk to the production team.
No.
That is not helping. We're not winning the Emmy with that.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
We're not going to the Oscars with that kind of dynamic. So I think there's, like, a great divide, or two solitudes, we would say, in Canada. And, like, let's bridge that gap.
Yeah.
It's not a power struggle. Equal power but different responsibilities.
Yeah.
Like, you need your supervisor. So you're nothing without your supervisor.
What would be, like, some ways? I mean, I can think of some, but I wonder what you're thinking about that you would use to build trust with your artist team.
So there are 8 like behaviors that really help us build trust. The first one is clarity. So making sure that your processes and F-track are clear, that we understand why the goal is the goal, that in the scrum in the morning, we all understand the same thing, right? Not that we leave the scrum and we're like, we need another meeting, like, we don't know.
Yeah.
Like, clarity. And the production team, we should be very transparent about why everything, and about also, like, the processes that help us help the artist. So there's clarity. The first one is having character. So doing what's right rather than doing what's easy. So you come and tell me, I think, like, I'm getting bullied by the rating department. Like, it's been weeks. I'm trying to avoid the conflict, but I think this person's bullying me. Well, the easy thing to do is saying, like, oh, no, you're probably just tired. Like, I'll talk to them. Like, don't worry. The right thing to do is to, like, actually listen and investigate and be like, what do you need from me in this situation? How can I help you? What are the steps that we should take in order to make sure that you don't get bullied? Or something like that. The third one is compassion. So having a mission together. So the mission is not like winning the Emmy. The mission is not your personal demo. What's our mission? I used to say, like, I want all the clients to come work with our team because we make their jobs easier, because what we produce is so cool, because, like, they'd rather work with us than anybody else in the world. Like, that was the mission. It's a big mission. Like, it could be something smaller. It could be something smaller. I have big ideas. So... having a mission. What are the other ones? So they all start by C. Collaboration is extremely important as well. So you want to show the artist that you're with them, right? That you're not against them, or that you're not, like, in an ivory tower where they cannot reach you. Like, you're there on the floor with them, and you're in the trenches, let's say, with them. Then you have like competency, so offering training, putting like a mentorship system in place, having a buddy system, letting the people in your team learn things so that they feel like they're always growing and that they're always more competent and that they're being recognized for their strengths, actually. Then I don't know how many that is, but
I don't know either. I think it's like five.
But like, these are things that like scientifically from a organizational behavior science and like research backs the fact that these things help you build trust.
Yeah.
So it's really important to be intentional about them. I think working remotely, it's even more important because a lot of that trust is going to be created at the cafeteria. When you're having a coffee,
right?
When you're, you know, in the baking club or you go karaoke, you know, in cocktail hour, a lot of like getting to know each other on a deeper level will happen in these activities. And working remotely, if the person is in another country, they have a different culture, like, and we don't take the time to get to know them, then really it's going to be hard. There's going to be a wall between like us and them. And you know, you can't just be like, we want to build trust. Come on, trust me, you know? It's something that's a bit more, that needs to be finessed. So one of the things that we like to do the most for working remotely is the one-on-one meeting. And I used to do it all wrong because I used to call everybody in for a one-on-one meeting and then push my agenda on them and be like, this is the milestone. This is where you look at your due date. this is how we use ShotGrid. And like, no, that's not it at all. You create like a one-on-one space where you just talk about each other. You know, do you have pets? Do you have children? Are you taking a holiday soon? What's your dream? If you got a promotion tomorrow, what would it be? What's your dream show? Like just getting to know each other on a more personal level and creating this space where you have active listening and they feel like they can just, like they're the at the forefront of the conversation. So it can be like a 10, 15 minute meeting, but that you do repeatedly, like not once every year, you know, you do it every 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And then they know that they have this moment so that if they feel like they're being bullied, if they're demotivated because they're lonely on their side of the planet, if, you know, they don't understand what the client is saying half the time, that they have like a space where they can tell you. So it works as a supervisor with artists, it works as a production crew. If you're a coordinator, you do it with your artists in the round. You know, your round is all about the goals, but you should also have a space where they can tell you like, you know, my parents are sick, I'm not feeling my best, like my motivation's not there. You wanna know these things so that you can best support the people. We used to hide that. I feel like I'm so old when I say that. Like back in the 80s, we would hide all that stuff. You know, there used to be a stereotype like don't bring yourself at work, right? Like keep your problems at home. Nowadays, psychological safety, so bringing your whole self at work, is one of the most important things for an organization to develop and to thrive. It's more profitable to know about the people's problems, to know about their strengths and weaknesses perceived by them, especially in a creative field, and there's research behind that as well, that if you can bring your whole self to work, you're gonna have better ideas, you're gonna be more creative, you're gonna be more innovative. So you wanna have a space where you get to know the people. You know, now you're on Zoom, and if people chit-chat too much at the beginning, it annoys some people, so then you don't chit-chat too much, but then you miss on that opportunity to know, like, what did you do this weekend? Oh my God, like, you did that? That's fun. Where did you do that? I want to do that too. Like, we do miss on that, and I understand that not every space is a space for it, but being super intentional, like, the best way to create trust is to decide that that's a task in our task description, and that that's a high, high, high priority. Because if we trust, then we're creative. You know, if people are scared of saying they don't know, if they don't want to raise their hands because you told them once but they forgot, if they don't want to pitch an idea in case, like, they get made fun of, then we're missing out on, like, so many opportunities to be creative together and to do our best work. That's not what we want.
Right.
Like, the people in the industry are, like, so smart. We need to create a setting in which they feel free to share ideas so that they can blow our mind and then we can take it to the next level, you know?
I just want to say, well, we haven't talked a lot about happy producers specifically, so I wanted to kind of bring it up. And I think it's really impressive that you were so, well, I'm sure you said you had a co-founder also?
Yes.
Okay.
Louis-Philippe. Vermette.
It's really awesome that you're taking the steps and taking the time and dedicating the energy to not just better your own workflow and the way that you set up your team relationships, but also to influence other producers. I feel like a lot of the I don't know a lot of the production sort of upbringing. I don't really know how it works, but I do know that there has been a few instances where I see that people just start being coordinators and then they immediately get a production position right after that, but there's not necessarily anything in between or any kind of training in between or anything like that. So I think happy producers is so important. It's so key to everything to be a little bit smoother. I mean, I can't express enough how important it is, and I really hope that everybody goes. I mean, I feel like I should go take a class.
Even just to
learn a little bit more about it, yeah. Do you have any plans for happy producers to grow, or how is it set up right now?
So, when we launched the happy producers, we just celebrated like 2 years since our first e-course. Mm-hmm. We decided to be on a mission to just enhance well-being in the animation industry.
It's also such a niche, like, is that the word? Is that how you say it? Niche?
Yes.
Such a niche thing to do, because I feel like production is huge everywhere, right? So it's specifically for animation, which I think is so important because it's so different. It's
yes.
Just completely different beast.
Yeah. And it's just like, there were two things. So the first thing we realized is that exactly, very, very, very few people, and I want to say hi to the people that do have a classic training. There are a few of them that I know, but very few people have like a bachelor in management. Like I was set up to be a film and cinema teacher. LP, who's my co-founder, is an executive producer. Now he started as a storyboard artist. So you learn as you go. You learn on the job. So you do your best, like nobody has ill intentions, but you're lacking the support, you're lacking the hard information, the data about this works better than this way of doing things. And so we were looking for it for ourselves, like we wanted continual growth because we believe that training is not because there's a problem. You don't train somebody because they have a problem or there's something missing. You train people because it's motivating, because people in our industry are ambitious, because it's more profitable for our team, because it's more fun. If all of our processes are streamlined and we have clarity, then it's better for us. It's better for our artists. So we wanted that for us, and we just couldn't find something that was specific to animation. We would take like documentary co-production, you know, workshops, and then you apply a few things, but we were like, we're missing an opportunity here. So there was that. So we decided to create our own first training in the team that we had back then. I had a team of about 100 people. So there were maybe like 8 coordinators and project managers doing things just a little bit differently. Everybody was doing things a little bit differently. And we were delivering, but it was stressful, like by the seat of our pants. By the edge of our seat? By the
seat of our pants is definitely not it.
We were delivering, but like barely, you know, like if the delivery was Friday at 5, like at 4:49, we were running around like crazy people. So I wanted it to be like lower stress because it was a TV series, high volume, like you need to have a better strategy. So we, you know, asked higher management to help us train them and they wouldn't. And, you know, we look high and low and couldn't find it. So we decided to take 1 hour a week for 8 weeks where it was just like training. And at first it felt stressful because it's like, we don't have that hour, or that's like, that's such a stereotype of production, right? There's no time. There's no time for anything. We're already so busy. So we're like, we're taking that hour. It wasn't on a lunch hour. It was in the day, you know, it was part of our work day. And in 8 weeks, we gained about 20% of efficiency in the production team. And like, we were pleasantly surprised. And then we realized that, yeah, we had streamlined all of our processes and documented all of our processes, but we had also spent a lot of time talking about our mindset and our values and our team culture, our dream job, what we wanted our clients to say about us, what we wanted for ourselves and for our team. And we realized that there was a huge impact there. Like, we all got so much closer. We got closer to the artists. And then if we had more clarity about our processes, then we realized that our artist's job was so much easier because they're not wondering how to use F-Track now. Mm-hmm. They know because we have a little five-step process that's mm-hmm. documented, that all of their coordinators are doing it the same way. So from one show to the other, they're not like confused, you know? Mm-hmm. And we were like very, very excited about the results. And then the pandemic happened. So that was like November. And then by March, like the pandemic happened. Mm-hmm. And we got even more efficient. Like, it was like we had the smoothest transition in the history of like pandemic production because we didn't know the pandemic would happen, but we were ready.
Right.
So we were ready for the surprises because we had invested that time in refining our processes. Mm-hmm. And then we're like, okay, like we need to be able to share this with the world. Mm-hmm. And I was leaving the studio where I was for many, many happy years, and I was worried because I was like, who takes care of them when I'm gone? Who talks about these values when I'm gone? Like, who sets boundaries mm-hmm. when I'm not there to like coach them about boundaries? And we realized that this is something we could share like more widespread. Mm-hmm. I changed studios, and so, you know, just like production training already was like a big, it was important for us, and like continuous education, not just like I'm a younger person thinking about maybe going in the field, but for the people already in the field, how do they up-level, you know? And then I changed studio and started getting like sexually harassed like at that studio where I had like an executive position. So I like didn't expect that like the higher, I thought that going up in the hierarchy would always keep me safe and right. would always give me the impact that I wanted on my team. Uh-huh. But then myself and my team were getting sexually harassed. And when you go into the process, when you start saying, okay, we have this issue at work, how do we resolve it? And you see how everybody around you is just like devoided of any tool to know how yeah. to resolve it. So they do what they think. Mm-hmm. And it was all the wrong things right. from like a human perspective, from an business culture perspective, from a legal perspective, turns mm-hmm. out, because, you know, there are laws that prevent us from getting harassed at work. And that was like, it was extremely hard to go through. Like, it was a bad experience, but I'm very grateful for it because it helped me see how much soft skills are lacking. But everybody's doing their best, but we're not trained. Mm-hmm. Somebody comes and tells me I'm getting sexually harassed. What do I do?
Yeah.
Like, what do I do? And their answer was like, let's put it under the carpet the because rug, we yeah. don't know. Like,
classic.
And like, I didn't judge them. I might have judged them back then because it was like so hard going through that. Mm-hmm. But then I realized if we all knew better, we would do better. So we decided that the courses were going to be, yes, production processes, but let's start boosting our emotional intelligence. Let's start getting essential soft skills that we need in a creative field in order to not survive but thrive. You know, it gave me a huge amount of stress to be going through that experience, and then I had to have an operation at the same time, which was most likely linked. My oncologist would say that.
Oh my gosh.
My oncologist would be like, yes, it was the stress at work. And it was a big operation, mm-hmm. and I was lying on the gurney at the hospital that morning.
Oh my gosh.
You know, naked in a little paper gown.
Yeah.
And it was a Wednesday morning in February. Oh, it's like 3 years basically this week.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like I was at the spa. I was like, what a relaxing moment for myself to be naked on the hospital gurney about to undergo surgery for like cancer. So relaxing. And like that really raised the huge flag that I'd rather be there than be at work.
Yeah.
And like production is my passion. It's mm-hmm. my like my vocation. Mm-hmm. And I would have rather been getting surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Than being at work. So that's on that gurney that the Happy Producers were founded. At first it was like, yes, training, but then I realized we need to all skill up when it comes to soft skills. Mm-hmm. So my partner and I trained as coaches because, you know, you don't just mm-hmm. throw your opinions around when it comes to emotional intelligence. So mm-hmm. we both trained as coaches, took it very seriously, and then launched the Happy Producers. And so now we show like the how-to, but mostly like the mindsets mm-hmm. that you need, because like when I had that experience, I started talking to a lot of people my age, like I'm over 40, and realized that a lot of people above 40 want to quit because mm-hmm. like what you realize at one point, like what are we working 60 hours a week for?
Yeah.
missing the kids, you know, pageants and this, and like, what is it all worth? Like, at the end of the day, I don't know that I can sustain that for another like 20 years. And I thought that it was sad that we had to consider leaving the field. And, you know, people would say, that's how it is. It's never going to change. Like, that's one of my triggers.
Oh, yeah.
Because, says who? Who decided? It wasn't me. I didn't decide that. Like, says who, and why are we deciding this person was right?
I hear that a lot from even animation animation people who have been in the industry for a long time. They're always like, ah, oh, you know, that happens, you know,
Over time is normal. And that's like, how it is in the industry. Yeah. It's normal that I work on a Saturday. Says who? Says who?
Well, you're such a, like, process-oriented person. I wanted to ask, if you don't mind, how did you, what was your process for, like, reacting to the sexual harassment?
I mean, sexual harassment is hard because it's hard not to take it personal. And for me, it was somebody that I knew from the industry for a long, 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 long time and, like, really didn't expect it.
And recognizing that you might have done something when it happened, that and then now you think, like, there's something you should have done maybe differently, or...
Yeah, I think my problem, what I did wrong was to be process-oriented and try to fix it myself. So for me, it would happen in front of the client, so I decided, well, that person is no longer going to be invited in client conversations, right? So that we just avoid the situation.
Right.
Because my goal was the film. We have a, it was my first streamer film. I love these clients. Like, how do we make this film without my mental health, like, paying for this? And then the other women in my team also, like, I wanted to protect them as well. So I think, like, don't try to fix it yourself. Like, no matter where you are in the world, there are laws that protect employees. So if your employer doesn't know what to do, if... You know, they tell you to keep it for yourself, if they bully you because you file a complaint. In my case, the HR director got fired. Like,
oh my gosh.
It was like the storm. Like, it was a storm of bad things. Like, there are processes. This is a legal matter. Mm-hmm. Bullying and harassment are not allowed at work in Canada. There are laws to prevent it. It's not personal to your employer. Doesn't mean your employer is a bad employer. Doesn't mean the studio is a bad studio. They're not going to be on a red list forever if you file a complaint. But there are laws. So just, like, get informed. Here in Quebec, there is La Parte, which is a free resource of lawyers that you can just call anonymously if you want, that will just tell you, like, what's the context.
Okay.
What's available to you? What are the things that are allowed and not allowed? For example, if you are going through sexual harassment and you then get demoted for filing a complaint, or you file a complaint and then you get less responsibilities or you get treated differently, that's illegal, right? Mm-hmm. So there's just a process for it. If your employer doesn't know what to do with it, it's not personal. Don't get mad at them. Like, they might just not have, like, the tools and resources, but there's other tools and resources out there that exist. Don't think that's how it is. It will never change. Like, that's not okay. And I don't want to sound tone deaf, because I'm on LinkedIn. Like, I know that it's been a hard few months when it comes to layoffs and things, but there's always another employer.
Yeah.
Like, don't stay somewhere where your values are misaligned.
100% agree.
Burnout happens because we have chronic stress. Chronic stress is a stress we have every day. You only need 21 days of stress every day to be at risk of burnout. Mm-hmm. So the number one factor is chronic stress. And the second factor for burnout is being misaligned to your own values. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not something you're going to fix with an extra day off.
Yeah.
So there's another employers. You can be a freelancer. You can come work at Agora. Like, there are places that have beautiful cultures. Don't think that's how it is. And, you know, there's a lot more women in the industry than there were when I first started. Mm-hmm. It's not just women that go through harassment, but a woman out of two here in Quebec. So that's a lot. Like, for me, I thought it was really important to speak up. And it's really hard for me to even be here to admit this, right?
Yeah,
because then what are people going to think?
Yeah.
Like, there was a lot of fear when I first started to talk about it. But it's important to use our voice so that it doesn't happen to other people.
Yeah.
Because if we keep it to ourselves, then that employee that was at the root of the harassment thinks that their behavior is okay.
Yeah.
It's possible that they didn't realize.
They didn't even know.
Like, they're not evil neither. What I didn't want was for this person to get fired. Like, I knew their spouse. I knew their children. I wasn't like, we're firing. But I wanted the behavior to change.
Stop. Yeah.
So it's not the person that's wrong or evil, it's the behavior that's wrong. And you can change a behavior. Like, you can change any behavior.
I'm picking up something super, super inspiring from you. Above all the lists and all the things that you're mentioning, there's like a common theme here where you are like constantly making sure that you're giving every situation the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
Like you're constantly making sure that you take blame away from whatever the person is in front of you, whatever the situation is, so that then you can look at it more objectively and figure out a solution for it. I think that's kind of like the overall theme I'm seeing here with you.
Oh, I love that.
Awesome. Yeah.
I love that. I think like it can be hard to believe. And it's a choice. Like our outlook on everything is a choice.
Yeah.
Mindset is a choice. Mindset exists through connections in our brain. We can rewire every single connection in our brain. Mm-hmm. The way we think about things is a choice. Yeah. We're not like victims of how we were born thinking or, mm-hmm. you know, so we can always change that. But that's what I was gonna say. Yes, so my mindset, and I had to work to get there. Like, it wasn't like, you know, I have attitude and I get frustrated too, but mm-hmm. everybody is doing their best.
Yeah.
And in my opinion, it might not seem like it most of the time, but my choice is to know that nobody is showing up at work to ruin anybody else's day. Mm-hmm. Nobody is like, I'm going to be the best bully. I'm going to win the Emmy for bullying. Like, nobody wants that reputation, right? So everybody is doing their best. My mm-hmm. client that was screaming, they were doing their best. It wasn't mm-hmm. about me. They were reacting to something else. My colleague that thinks it's funny to make jokes about, you know, women's breasts into a client meeting, they're doing their best. Do I like their best? No. But, you know, like, nobody is setting out to be an evil person, especially in our industry. Like, I don't believe that one second.
Yeah.
Like, it needs to be, like, a huge exception. Mm-hmm. So everybody's doing their best, reacting to a context. And, like, let's not take things personal. And
I mean, I think this applies to life in general, but especially in animation, because we're so intertwined. Like, every decision you make is going to affect somebody else in the pipe or, like,
anybody in the
project. So, yeah.
And I think just, again, like, we're in such a criticizing environment day in and day out mm-hmm. that we have a really great opportunity to learn not to take things personal.
Yeah.
You know, if I work at the bank and I only get feedback once a year, then my feedback muscle is not very strong. Mm-hmm. But every day I'm getting feedback at the animation industry, even in the production team. I might not be told, like, this is not working and that, but the way that my artists are acting, the way that, you know, we have the trust or we don't have the trust, the way that the goals are clear or not, that's all feedback about how my production team and mm-hmm. I are doing. Mm-hmm. It's a really good opportunity to not take things personal.
Yeah.
Like,
it's such, like, we're so lucky that, I mean, I think when I first started out, I felt really stressed about that. I felt kind of tired, extra tired every day because it's tiring to sit there and take the feedback and internalize it and then work and no matter how you feel about it, you still have to apply it, you know? Like,
that's true.
There's
yeah.
So it's it was always very tiring, and I think I saw it as a negative when I first started. But now, you know, 7 or 8 years later, I feel like it's probably one of the things that has helped me in life in general. Not just for animation, but like just, you know, being able to take feedback in a way that isn't, you know, taken personally or disruptive to myself or hurting my identity or I think that's really awesome.
And if the feedback goes against your own values, then it's totally okay to set boundaries.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like, if you're being asked to physically do something that
I'm still working on the boundaries part.
But. You're not an interview. Oh, boundaries are a superpower. They are so important.
So difficult especially for I mean, I don't want to speak for every artist, but for myself, it's really, really difficult because I'm constantly wanting to make the project better or the thing that I'm making. I'm sacrificing like what myself for this thing to be the way that I want it to be. So I feel like setting boundaries is a little bit hard, especially if they're going to affect how much time I can spend on it or, you know, I don't know.
I think we're always scared of boundaries until we implement them, because people often tell me, because boundaries is one of my big teams, like, what if somebody reacts negatively to me setting a boundary?
Yeah.
But like, if we have boundary, it's freeing for other people, because then it lets them know that they're allowed to have boundaries as well.
Yeah.
All of our boundaries are different. Mm-hmm. But if you start telling people, then they're allowed to have boundaries as well. It's very freeing. Mm-hmm. And saying no to something is saying yes to yourself and your own well-being. And your well-being is the most precious thing that you have. Like at 85, you're not gonna remember on that project. Like I missed a Christmas pageant one year for my stepdaughter.
Oh my God.
And I was talking about that with my husband recently, and I have no idea what I was doing. But I remember that she was dancing like she was a little reindeer with Santa's sleigh, and her dad went and they danced together, and we have a video of that, and I wasn't there to see the reindeer dance. I remember that. I don't remember what, like, even the project I stayed at work to do. So the first thing with boundaries is just knowing what are our bottom lines for us. We don't need to have 25 boundaries, right? Mm-hmm. For me is you can project your stress at me. So if you're stressed, we can talk about it. Active listening is not my best thing. So we can talk about it for like, you know, 7 minutes. But then I'm gonna ask you to bring solutions. Yeah. So if you're bringing a problem, we're not venting, you're also bringing a solution. I have all the solutions. I miss solution. I'm gonna ask you to bring your own solution. So that's one of my boundaries. I dream my whole life of having a closed office with a door. Mm-hmm. And the moment I had it, like people would come, vent their stress and leave. And they're like, Virginie does such a great job at managing my stress. And it's like, no, you're allowed to come in my office anytime. You will be asked to bring a solution. Right. Like that's one of my boundaries. I also have no notifications. That's always been a boundary. And like, I've had a great career. No notifications. So you chat me and I'm not at work. I don't know. It's not on my phone. So
right.
I believe emergencies are not a thing in our industry. We make everything a fake emergency. Mm-hmm. We use the term 911 and things like drop dead deadline, which, like, let's retire all of these terms.
Yeah.
There are no emergency. An emergency is something that puts your life at risk, mm-hmm. and that requires immediate attention. Like, when was the last time your life was at risk at the animation studio? I'm curious. Like, I'm curious to know. So all of these fake, like, paradigms that we accept, setting boundaries just helps us, like, change these paradigms and create the workplace culture that we want.
Yeah.
It's okay to do it. You know, my best friend is the compound effect, doing small things repeatedly. Mm-hmm. So it's the same thing with boundaries. It's the same thing with stress management. It's the same thing with influencing your clients, building trust, mm-hmm. changing your mindset. Just like small little things mm-hmm. every day. We're not going to change who we are like in a moment or change our habits, but like every day saying, okay, every day I'm going to do a little thing that's going to help me like build up to a place where I can set more boundaries, where it's mm-hmm. going to be like healthier for me. And then I'm also going to ask my colleagues what some of their boundaries are, you know? Yeah. My colleague that would sexually harass us, he would throw stuff as well, like the stapler.
Oh my gosh.
He'd get frustrated, the water bottle, the stapler. And I had to like tell them like, no.
Yeah.
Strong boundary. Like, this scares me. It makes me feel like my physical integrity is at risk at the studio. Like, this is not acceptable behavior at work. You're being asked to like stop throwing the stapler like right away. Mm-hmm. So they seem like extreme examples, but mm-hmm. by saying that, I'm protecting myself, I'm protecting everybody in my team. And he also know then that he can say no to other stuff. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, Virginie, you, when you do that, if you call me at 9:30 on a Friday, no.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, fair enough. Yeah. I received that. Like, I agree with that. We feel like we have to be on call like all the time. We feel like we have to be available all the time. Like, that's a lie.
Yeah.
Like, doctors are not on call all the time.
Yeah.
Like, it's a false sense of importance little bit.
Yeah. Ooh, I feel like I need a walk. There's so much good information. I can't, you know, there's so much gold coming out of your mouth right now.
Oh.
So thank you for taking the time. I really appreciate you being here and talking with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me. Yeah. You know, using our voice can be really hard, but yeah, having a platform to do so like really helps.
Yeah, I hope to just, you know, we're all working from home currently, so I really hope that this kind of conversation that is going to be available worldwide, it will be useful for everybody who is feeling a little bit disconnected as well.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes. We're all, like, no matter where we are in the world, we're all part of the animation planet.
Yeah.
And, like, the community is just such a thing of beauty, so, like, yeah, it's there. Let's connect and, like, let's make the most of it. Like, yeah, the people in the community are just amazing. Yeah.
I'm going to ask you one last additional question because I'm not sure. Have you worked with Agora before?
I've hired Agora to to do work. I haven't worked at Agora. I had the huge pleasure of training some of the project managers and line producers and coordinators that work with Agora.
Awesome.
They're so amazing. And, like, just at Agora, what I find is, like, the mindset is so great. And well-being is being seen as a business model, which it is. And I think that that's so important and that they're industry leaders in that way, in the sense that they're the proof that it's possible for all the studios that are like, no, but if we, like, stop bullying everybody and working 60 hours a week, we're just going to fold and go bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
Agora is kind of the proof that that's not the case at all. Yeah. Like, it's time for a new business model.
Yeah, agreed. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.